Hello everyone and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
One of our member states has been treated in a way that is not acceptable. So we want to know what happened and why.
World leaders gather in New York and I talk to the European Commission president about Europe's fury with Biden and how best to make up to battle climate change and COVID. Then
many of them are sleeping out in the open. Food is very scarce in the country.
Just back from Afghanistan, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees joins me with a dire warning. Act now or face an even bigger catastrophe ahead. Plus,
I was brought here when I was 3. I've been here for over 30 years.
Facing deportation from the country you call home, writer, director, and actor Justin Chong talks to Hari Srinivasan about his new film, Blue Bayou, and finally,
I understand why. Close your eyes.
From Bristol, England to Nashville, Tennessee, singing sensation Yola joins me. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. The UN General Assembly Week is kicking off in New York. After a virtual event last year, world leaders are now gathering face to face, and top of the agenda are COVID and climate. But democratic nations, which had hoped the Biden administration would take long-time alliances more seriously than Trump did, are perhaps asking now, is the honeymoon over? On the eve of this event, the United States, Australia and Britain, so-called AUKUS, have stabbed France in the back. Those are the words of its foreign minister. And here's how he puts it.
Il y a eu duplicité.
There has been lying, duplicity, a major breach of trust and contempt. This will not do. Things are not going well between us. They are not going well at all. It means there's a crisis.
France is furious with Washington for striking a deal to provide nuclear-powered submarines to Australia, cutting out Paris, which had the deal in the first place. Now a trade deal between the EU and Australia is in doubt. China is furious that these vessels are coming to its region, and Beijing could seek to exploit these divisions in the Western alliance. To discuss this and the consequences, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen joined me for an exclusive interview from New York. Madam President, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
There you are at the beginning of UNGER, and it's clearly overshadowed by this AUKUS, as we've all been talking about for the last few days. You've also already seen the French recall their key ambassadors over this issue, and China again saying we don't want nuclear technology in our backyard and raising some very serious issues. Just on the EU-Australia cancellation, why did that happen?
Well, there are a lot of open questions that have to be answered. And therefore, one of our member states has been treated in a way that is not acceptable. So we want to know what happened and why. And therefore, you first of all clarify that before you keep on going with business as usual.
Do you feel that Europe has been dissed? That yet again, the United States has not consulted you on an important move after Afghanistan, and that most importantly, it might create division and allow China to seek division between you allies. Are you worried about that?
Well, I can very well understand the disappointment in Europe about the way this issue was handled. You know, we're friends and allies, and friends and allies, partners, talk to each other. And they talk to each other mainly on an issue of common interest. So this did clearly not happen, and I think we need to talk. But on the other hand, we also have, as you mentioned, many important topics on our global agenda where we are working side by side, be it the health issue, be it climate change, working for our democracies. These are just a few examples.
Exactly. And I want to talk about how this may affect those agendas. But I want to know whether you think, talking about democracy and dictatorship, that this is a way that China could seek to create divisions between the democracies. What do you feel about that?
We will certainly not let that happen because we know exactly who our friends and allies are. And we know that we have shared values, that we have common interests, These talks are going on, but again, we also have to focus on the pressing global topics that we have to deal with. This is the topic of climate change. That is how to overcome the pandemic, or, for example, the effect of digitalization, just to name a few.
Do you think that you have, I know you've spoken a lot about it, you know, build back better, put climate into the post-COVID build back, and it's a centerpiece of what you've spoken about many, many times. Some people are not convinced. You know, they say, yes, there's a lot of kind words, a lot of good words, but they're still not that overwhelming, you know, sort of getting together by all governments to make this happen. And there's still divisions between Europe, between the United States, between China, India, and the rest. And you can also see what's happening in the UK right now with this massive sudden gas crisis, whether this will even work out by the host.
Yeah, indeed. So we know that, and we've seen this summer, what climate change does already to our people and our economies, deadly flooding, devastating fires, desertification, just to name a few topics. So it's time to step up. And there's a second thought in it. I'm deeply convinced that in fighting climate change, there's also a new growth strategy. Because what do we have to do? We have to put a price on carbon. So we have to cut drastically back pollution. We have to restore nature. The destruction of nature has to stop. And we have to move forward into a circular economy where we give back more to nature than we take from it. These are the principles. And the European Union has proven that you can work with that in a way. We have cast our goals for 2030 and 2050 in a European law. We have put out a detailed roadmap, sector by sector, how we want to get there. At the beginning, there were a lot of discussions about that. But my experience is, the moment you're there with very clear leadership and orientation where we want to go and how we want to go there, everybody is aligning and going with us in the same direction. Business, the economy, business has understood that we have really to move forward to a circular economy, and we have to think now about the innovation and the financing that we can put forward to get there.
Well, you'll be in New York. You are in New York. It's the center of business and capitalism. There's been a lot of complaints, even by those who have, you know, claimed to be socially responsible on climate, that business is seriously still after the bottom line. What they invest in are their fossil fuel investments. And even the American climate czar, John Kerry, told me that the bottom line is still what counts. Do you think you will have any attempts, efforts, successes in trying to get business and, of course, governments on board on a realignment of investment when it comes to protecting the climate?
So what business is concerned, we're making the experience in the European Union that they have understood that all of us have to step up to fight climate change. I give you an example. The European Commission is issuing green bonds. They were heavily, and that's positive, oversubscribed. So there's a lot of search for truly sustainable green project to invest in. That's good. We've seen that we now build alliances with the economic sector and the private investment, for example, to create green hydrogen so that you go through innovation and investment. But there's also a second element I don't want to miss to mention. The major economies, the developed economies, have a duty also to finance the climate change issues that the least developed and most vulnerable countries have. There is a promise since the Paris Agreement that major economies will finance every year $100 billion to support least developed and most vulnerable countries to adapt to climate change. And Europe did its share in the last years and will continue to pay its fair share. But I really call on the other major economies to also step up their ambition. This is absolutely needed if we want really to be successful in the fight against climate change.
You're absolutely right. These governments must. And as we all know, and you started out by saying it, so many of those promises have not yet been kept since Paris. Also on COVID, you know better than any, There was a huge promise to distribute fairly, justly, humanely COVID vaccines, COVID care, and that just hasn't happened. EU, of course, has stepped up its vaccination. It's ahead of the US right now. But when it comes to Africa and elsewhere, it's just not. Dr. Christos Christou, the head of Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, says the EU likes to portray itself as a champion of vaccine equity, but the gap between those beautiful words and its actions is embarrassingly wide. The EU continues to block initiatives to help other countries produce their own vaccines and therapeutics and has not shared promised vaccine doses on time. And that's a fact. And you are president of the Commission. Madam President, what do you say about that? What can you say to encourage them?
Yeah, let's set the record straight. We were the only region in the world that throughout this whole pandemic has kept open the export of vaccines. Every second doses of COVID vaccine that has been produced in Europe left Europe and went to other countries. 130 different countries have been served. Up to today, we have produced round about 1.5 billion doses of vaccines. 750 million doses went abroad to other countries, while 750 million doses also were delivered to the Europeans. As I said, we were the only ones, and it was tough in between. There's a second point that is correct. We also need to donate plain and simply doses in kind. Absolutely right from your citation. And here, indeed, the European Union will donate 500 million doses till the middle of next year, 250 million doses still this year, and the second half then in the first six months of the next year. And the third point you were mentioning is the production of vaccines, for example, in Africa. Here we've done a major step forward. It's not for the short term, but building up manufacturing capacities in Africa is an important mid and long term goal.
Let's just quickly touch on Afghanistan. Europe, the United States, the West had a clear bottom line, that human rights have to be respected, that women's rights have to be respected. And we now hear the latest news is that the girls are not going back to school, boys are being called back. What will it take for the EU to actually make its voice heard on this issue and the conditions by which you might even recognize the Taliban? Are you there yet?
So, indeed, the events in Afghanistan are a tragedy for the Afghan people and a severe blow for the international community. So first and foremost important task is there is a humanitarian crisis and famine is threatening major parts of the population. So we plain and simply, first of all, have to help. And yes, then there are the talks with the Taliban. These are operational talks. The Taliban need us to get through the worst difficulties at the moment being in Afghanistan. This is not a recognition of the Afghan government, but we need on a very practical basis to talk to them because there is, as you said, a lot of stake at stake. And we have to negotiate ongoing with them so that we can secure rights for vulnerable people, for women, for girls in Afghanistan, while working with a very difficult government.
Do you really think that's going to happen, women's rights?
We will see over time. We have to do everything to support those who are keeping up the fight in Afghanistan or who left Afghanistan and are working from abroad. This is our shared agenda. I mean, this was one of the reasons why we were there for 20 years to support the Afghan people to live up, to develop a democracy and an inclusive society. So indeed, this is a severe setback, as I said, for the international community, but you cannot give up. You have to work to improve things, even under very, very difficult circumstances.
In your State of the Union speech, you, who are a previous defense minister, you did actually make another call for more EU defense autonomy. This seems to be something that's going to go forward, and the French are calling for it as well. Can I get you to answer that?
So, indeed, what we've seen over the last weeks and months again is the fact that It is important for the European Union to have the capability that are needed when there's the political will to act and to change things. So we will step up to build our European Defence Union. Many of our member states are members of NATO, and NATO is the strongest military alliance in the world. But it is important to have a strong European pillar in NATO and to have for the European Union the capabilities to act independently in theatres where, for example, NATO is not, but the European Union is called upon. A second reason is we really need to step up to fight the new kind of threats we see. These are hybrid attacks. These are cyber attacks. Here we have to become more self-assertive and more independent. And these are topics which we will develop now. We will have a European Defence Summit in France at the beginning of the next year to discuss how we structure the way forward. In the meantime, we're working on the very practical steps that have to be done now to get more independence and more capabilities that are European.
Ursula von der Leyen, Commission President, thank you so much indeed for joining us today.
Thank you, Christian. Thank you for having me.
So signaling that the EU might strike out on its own a bit more. Now, after the US and NATO left Afghanistan, other governments are trying to figure out how to deal with the Taliban, as you heard. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees is just back from a three-day trip there, and he's sounding the alarm bells. Filippo Grandi says the humanitarian situation is desperate, and he's joining me now from New York. Filippo Grandi, High Commissioner, welcome to our program. You just heard Ursula von der Leyen, the EU Commission President, talk about famine, talk about catastrophe, building on what you've been warning about. Just tell me from your own eyes and what you saw there, what people are going through right now.
The humanitarian situation needs to be addressed very quickly. It's not new, of course, but it has developed after years of difficult access. Now, paradoxically, perhaps, there is more security in Afghanistan than we have seen in a long time. The fighting between the Taliban and the previous government has ended. So there is a space, at least, to expand quickly humanitarian operations. And the UN humanitarian agency, mine, UNHCR, and others, which have not left Afghanistan, we have never left Afghanistan even during the difficult days in August, we have the infrastructure and the capacity to step up quickly. And the Taliban, with whom I have spoken during my recent visit in recent days, are ready to give us that space and that security. So we need to dive into that space and try to meet the urgent needs before winter starts, which is in a few weeks, literally, in the country.
So what exactly do you need? I mean, we see pictures of tents. We heard Ms. von der Leyen talking about clean water, clean food. We've seen our own reporters there talking about the most horrendous sort of so-called shelters that are popping up around Kabul as people are trying to get out of Taliban areas and try to seek some safety. What exactly do you need, first and foremost? How much do you need from the international community in terms of, you know, tonnage or money?
Well, Christiane, I think you're right. The needs are big. Look, just from the perspective of my organization, there's 3.5 million displaced people, just displaced by violence and conflict. 500,000 recent ones. They need shelter. But the rest of the population needs everything. Food is a big priority. Medical care. Dr. Tedros, the head of WHO, is in Afghanistan as we speak. We're really keeping the pressure and multiplying the initiatives. We need money, first of all. The Secretary General the other day launched an additional appeal for $600 million. It was well subscribed. We need those pledges to come online very quickly, to be realized very quickly. But we need to sustain this humanitarian effort in the medium term. You know, we have a history in Afghanistan of getting resources when there is an acute crisis, and then those resources dry up. We cannot afford that now, because discussing with the Taliban on this, but also on all the other issues, women at work, education of girls, rights of minorities will be a complex and long negotiation and discussion, and we need to conduct it in a space that does not have a basic humanitarian crisis.
So are you basically saying that they are more willing to talk about resolving the humanitarian crisis before all the others, and that you're willing to allow them to do that?
I think that the line I've taken, and I've told them about this, is that, yes, we are ready. You know, there's a humanitarian imperative that cannot be held back by any political considerations, but that we need to use that discussion also to raise other issues that are of concern to everybody. You know, people say they are of concern to the international community. I would like to say they are of concern to the Afghan people. That's what we need to look into. And this includes the issues that I have mentioned. I have to say, in my own discussions, granted, preliminary ones, brief ones, at the very beginning of this interaction, but those discussions had a space. I was able to convey these points. I don't think it would be easy to have outcomes that are positive immediately, but the space for discussion exists, and we must engage with the Taliban. There's no plan B there. They militarily control the country, most of the country, so we need to engage.
So I'm really interested, because I don't know whether that's UNEs, you know, the space to talk about women's rights, when today we see that they're not allowing girls to school. They've just said stay home. They're not allowing any women to work, except, as they say, only if men can't do it. They've dismissed the Ministry of Women's Affairs and turned it into a vice and virtue ministry. They don't look like they have a lot of space for the things that, beyond survival, Afghan women and Afghan families want after 20 years. Where do you see the space?
I don't think that space is UNEs. We're talking about space for discussion. Right? I think the space exists. There is a possibility. I remember the Taliban in the late 90s. I met them, and it was much more difficult to even raise these issues. Now we can. We have to do with what we have. But the important thing is to continue to engage. It will be slow progress, if we're lucky. There will be progress, but it will be slow. But not to have this conversation, begin every conversation by putting red lines, I'm afraid, may not lead us very far. So while we discuss, we need to also deliver, because Afghan people, men and women, are hungry, need medical care, need water, need shelter, and that has to be delivered quickly.
So just on that point briefly, so you do see a difference between Taliban 1.0 and 2.0?
It's very early days. We're talking about the second month, but I would say yes.
What about on that, which is good news for the Afghan people, if that's correct, and for the international community? What about on the issue of COVID? Obviously, they were hit very, very badly. I just want to read some of these stats. You know, according to the UN, 86% of refugees, as you know better than anybody, are housed in developing countries. 80% of all vaccines has been given in high and upper income countries. In terms of refugees, whether around Afghanistan or elsewhere, how are they coping or not with the protection against COVID?
You know, Christiane, I'm sometimes surprised myself, but I have to say that globally, most countries hosting large numbers of refugees, I'm talking about millions, not the few tens of thousands here and there that some rich countries sometimes complain about. I'm talking about the millions that are present in African countries, in Asian countries, in Latin America. Well, most of those countries have not discriminated between nationals and refugees. Everybody was included in the health responses prior to vaccines, and now, when they have the vaccines, they include the refugees. Unfortunately, as you said, 90% of the refugees are in countries that have not received enough vaccines, so the refugees are penalized as everybody else. This is why the drive for vaccine equity, for vaccinating the world, I understand the United States is taking some initiatives in this respect, and I think it's very positive for them as well.
And where you are at the UN headquarters, obviously climate is going to be a huge thing, and we know all about climate migration. And in fact, you know, the new World Bank report predicts that climate change could displace more than 200 million people internally within their own countries by 2050. That's not too many years down the line. Huge, huge crisis. What needs to be in place by people like yourself and those who deal with migration and refugees to mitigate this, or can it be?
Well, first of all, of course, anything that needs to be done to address the climate emergency, reducing emissions, for example, applies to this as well. That's obvious, but it's important to say it. But then we need to look at the more detailed elements of this issue. There is already, as we speak, a lot of climate displacement. There is climate displacement because many times, for example, the climate emergency causes conflict. Look at West Africa, look at the Sahel, for example. Less resources because of the climate emergency, and the social cohesion between ethnic groups, for example, in countries like Niger or Burkina Faso, collapses, fighting starts, and then you have refugees or displaced people. So we need to look to analyze in a very granular way all these consequences of the climate emergency and address them one by one. Unfortunately, it's the same thing about COVID, right? Most of the displacement is in countries that are already very fragile because of climate. So the two things need to go together. The last point I want to make here is that let's look at responses to refugee crisis, not just from the humanitarian point of view, but also from the longer term climate developmental point of view. This is what we're trying to do with institutions like the World Bank, like bilateral development cooperation and so forth.
A huge agenda. Filippo Grandi, UN High Commissioner for Refugees, thank you for joining us. Now, since the end of World War II, 500,000 children have been adopted from abroad by American families. But at least 50 have been deported since 2000. That's according to the nonprofit Adoptees for Justice. The new film, Blue Bayou, highlights this pressing issue. It was written, directed, and stars former Twilight actor Justin Chon. It follows a Korean-born adoptee fighting for the only life he's ever known. And here he is talking to Hari Srinivasan about the Asian-American experience and even representation in Hollywood.
Christiane, thanks. Justin Chon, thanks for joining us. So tell us a little bit about who this character is.
Well, the film is about Antonio LeBlanc. He's in Korean-American adoptee. He was brought here when he was three. And he has a beautiful wife, played by Alicia Vikander, and a beautiful stepdaughter who's Caucasian. And through an altercation with his stepdaughter's father, who's a cop, he gets on ICE's radar and tries to fight to stay, to be with his family.
What gave you this idea to do an entire film about Korean Americans, or at least adoptees, that face deportation?
I have quite a few adoptee friends, and I started hearing that through the community that adoptees were being deported. You know, they were brought over here as children when they were very, very young, and you know, they were finding out as adults 20, 30 years later that they never had citizenship. You know, these are kids that came over from other countries, brought here by the U.S. citizens, and the adoptions were legally acknowledged by the government. So it was something that was absolutely shocking to me, and I felt, a strong need to shine a light on this issue.
You know, it's interesting because obviously they were children at the time. They didn't know what paperwork was necessary, but I guess their parents never officially filed for their citizenship. Is that the root cause here?
There's a myriad of reasons this happens. But yes, one of the reasons is they didn't fully go through the entire process, or, you know, some sort of paperwork was left out. I mean, also, mind you, this was when they were brought here. A lot of them were, it was during the 70s and 80s. So it wasn't as stringent of, you know, immigration policy and you know, the adoption process wasn't as stringent as it is today. Another thing is, you know, adoption is always talked about through rose-colored glasses. And, you know, we don't talk about how sometimes these parents, they bring these children over and they don't want them. So they're put up for, you know, adoption again or put through the foster care system. And, you know, if that's the case, there's no chance in hell that the parents, you know, proceeded with the whole naturalization process. It's, you know, if you've ever been through that, it's a very long process. And there's a lot of paperwork involved. And you know, oftentimes a lawyer is also involved as well. So if you've been put up and given up again, you know, a lot of times that's not going to happen.
There's a clip in the lawyer's office, and really it just the your character's wife is talking about how American you are.
He has two kids. I mean, listen to him, look at him. He's American.
It doesn't matter what he looked like. It's immigration policy.
I was brought here when I was three. I've been here for over 30 years.
Well, sometimes with these international adoptions in the 80s, the proper paperwork.
Yeah, but like I said, I've been here for over 30 years. Okay, can't you just tell them that I was adopted by white people?
I understand your frustration. I really do, but that's not how it works. I hear your options. You can depart voluntarily and have a chance of receiving status, or you can stay and appeal. But if you do that and the judge don't rule in your favor, you forfeit any opportunity to return to this country.
It was one of those sort of obvious yet strange scenes that you're having to prove yourself American.
Yeah, you know, that's one of the questions the films ask is, what is an American? Is it legality, or is it birth, or is it choice? You know, and it is quite peculiar because, you know, he's as American as American can be. You know, all of his tattoos are American traditional tattoos. You know, he has a very, you know, Louisiana, you know, distinct accent.
He told me I got a letter from my real mom. At first, I didn't believe him because why would she send me a letter after all that time?
But his face is Asian. And I think that this is happening across the country, and it's been happening since the Clinton administration. So it's a bipartisan issue. And, you know, it's a side of immigration policy that we haven't been seeing. You know, a lot of people don't know this is happening. Most of the time, immigration is about the border, and illegal crossings, but, you know, nobody thinks to imagine that it would affect adoptees brought here by U.S. citizens.
There's definitely a very strong kind of fatherhood, parenting, connection kind of storyline that goes through this as well. I mean, we find out a little bit more about your character's background and how difficult it was. Why did you write the character in such a way where, by all means, this guy looks like a pretty good dad to the stepdaughter?
He's human. You know, you can, the, you know, dualities exist in all of us. You know, it's also a question of, do we deserve second chances? You know, he's a flawed human. And I did that on purpose because I didn't want this to be some sort of propaganda piece. You know, I don't tell anybody what to think and what to believe in this film. I don't say what's right and wrong. I just present a man's life and, you know, just show one person's experience with this process, which means that, you know, he cannot be a perfect person. He does have a criminal record, but he's trying to mend the past and also become a good father and a good husband. You know, and me personally, just on a personal level, I have a daughter, and, you know, fatherhood is very important to me. And I don't see why an adoptee couldn't be a great father. You know, I also think that Antonio, the character, dealing with what he's dealt with and, you know, having gone through the foster care system, I think he would want to do everything he can to give everything he hasn't had to his children.
There's another clip in the film, which is early, and you're sitting down for a job interview and you get asked a question that I think almost every immigrant to America has gotten asked at some point. It's the "where are you from" question.
Antonio LeBlanc. How you get a last name like that?
I was adopted.
Hey, where are you from?
I'm from about an hour north of Baton Rouge, you know, small town called St. Francisville.
Where are you from, like born?
I see what you mean. I was born in Korea. LeBlanc. Yes, sir. Yeah, I mean,
it says here you have 2 felonies.
Yeah, but they were for nonviolent crimes. You know, I wouldn't hurt nobody.
What'd you steal?
You know, I could fix just about anything. You know, I could fix motorcycles, you know, cars. Hell, I could fix a lot.
What'd you steal?
Motorcycles, you know, but that was a long time ago. You know, I could, if you give me a chance, you know, I could be a real asset to your workplace.
How often have you, Justin John, gotten that question?
You know, it's happened like throughout my life. But, you know, growing up, yeah. Yeah, I heard it quite a bit. And, you know, it's always quite interesting to hear that question because I was born in the United States. I was born in California. And, you know, you say it's always the common thing of like it goes down the line of you tell them where you're from, what city you're from. And then they finally ask, no, where are your parents from? But what I do know is it's not the question that bugs me. It's usually depends on the intent. The intention. If it's meant to alienate, then yeah, it's quite destructive. But if it's really out of curiosity, then, you know, I do think it's harmless. You know, I've traveled the entire country and I've met a lot of people from all over. And what I have found is most people are very kind in this country. Most people, and when ignorant things are said, sometimes it's truly because they're curious and they just want to get to know you and they don't have a common ground.
There's also an incident that I don't know if most of the audience would recognize. Now, in this particular case, the interaction between the police and your central character, there's a personal connection there. But how Asian Americans or how Asians in the United States are treated by police, the excessive use of force in the film is not that surprising to some Asian Americans that have lived in this country.
My dad had a business in Compton. You know, I spent a lot of time there. You know, I was born in Garden Grove. I lived mostly, you know, very nice life in Irvine, middle class life. But, you know, a lot of my friends are from Garden Grove, which is, you know, not the best neighborhoods, also near Anaheim. But, you know, I've definitely experienced, you know, police, you know, force and whatnot. But the biggest thing is, you know, my family was looted during the LA riots, in 92. And that was, you know, obviously spurred by the Rodney King beating. You know, some people have been asking, how did you time this film so well? You know, because it's coming right off the heels of, you know, everything that's happened the last 2 years with George Floyd. And there was no timing. It's always been happening. It's just that, you know, in 2020, 2021, we have camera phones now that can document these things. Before, you had to be at the exact perfect right place in the right time with a video camera. But this, you know, the police brutality has been happening for decades. But I'm not saying all cops, you know, as you saw in the film, I'm not saying all cops are bad. You know, Ace, he has a reason for what he does. He really, you know, just wants to be a part of his daughter's life. And, you know, also my brother-in-law is a cop. So, you know, it's just, I'm just reporting on what I see and what my surroundings are and what I find truthful.
Do you think in the time since you've started to make the film till now, has the landscape in Hollywood changed much or how so? I mean, because on the one hand, we've had kind of the Me Too movement bring out some of the inequities. On the other hand, we've had, some successful films with Asian characters in it that are not just the sort of side role or a kind of a supporting actor, buddy comedy kind of things. But I'm curious to see, like, as an actor and as a director, what are you seeing?
It has changed. You know, there's still a long way to go. There's still a lot of work to be done. But, you know, since when I started in the year 2000, it's definitely, you know, the last 21 years, it definitely has changed. You know, I've been here to witness it, but, there's a, sort of, you know, chicken and the egg or, you know, sort of a dilemma, you know, here, because one of the biggest criteria to getting a film financed is having a movie star, a financeable movie star, which means that they can bring in foreign sales and you know, this whole archaic financial model of filmmaking. I don't think that applies anymore. You know, I don't think that applies anymore, but they still hold on to that. And it's, at times I feel like it can be a systemically racist model because, well, you're saying that, you know, we cannot cast an Asian as a lead because he's not financially, you know, viable, but we cannot become financially viable unless we have the opportunities to play the leads. So I don't know how to fix that problem. You know, so it's slowly happening and it needs to take a miracle. So, you know, like you get like a Henry Golding that he's not famous when he's the lead of a Crazy Rich Asians. And then now he's had a certain amount of box office success, then he is financeable to a certain degree. But you know, that's not happening very often compared to our white counterparts. And I still think there's a long way to go because it's still very, very difficult to, have an Asian led, film.
At the end of the film, in the credits, you've got images of adoptees that have either been deported or on the verge of being deported. What can be done about this?
You know, I'm not a politician, obviously, and I'm not, when it comes to politics, I'm a dummy. I can tell you how all the primaries and, you know, everything works to getting even the president elected. But you know, I am an artist and I made this film to shine a light on this issue. And that's my superpower, you know, bringing it to the masses and, you know, hopefully the right people see it. I've partnered with some groups like Adoptees for Advocacy and, you know, hopefully I can, you know, the right groups approach and the right legislators can see the film or it can be presented to them, you know, and what I do know is legislation is about exposure. You know, we need to know there's a problem for it to be fixed. And it needs, there's so many issues in this country that, you know, which one first, you know? So like the more attention I can draw to it, the more likelihood we can have for some action to take place. That's what my hope is that I just bring enough awareness and then the experts, in DC and people who do this type of work can take it from there. And I can lend my voice anytime on the emotional level. Whenever they need me.
The film is called Blue Bayou. Justin Chan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And the film is out in U.S. theaters now. And finally, while America can often be a deeply inhospitable place, one recent immigrant is achieving brilliant success in her new hometown of Nashville, Tennessee. The rising musical star Yola was born and raised in Bristol on England's west coast. But her love of great classic pop inspired her to set down roots in America's music city. Her first album out of Nashville, called Walk With Fire, earned Yola 4 Grammy nominations. And now her latest album, Stand For Myself, is on course to break out even bigger. And here's a clip from her new single, Diamond Studded Shoes. And Yola is joining me now from Nashville. Welcome to the program. Diamond Studded Shoes. It's a wonderful, wonderful song. Great tune. But it also comes with a helpful picture, I think, on which it was based. The crystal encrusted shoes of one female British prime minister. Is that right? Was that the inspiration?
That was the inspiration. Yes. Theresa May, probably not often thought of as an inspiration or a muse for music, but, you know, took a step into the left field and was inspired by those shoes and how incongruous and inappropriate they were, given the context within which they were being worn, which was to deliver news that we don't have any money anymore.
You know, it's really interesting that you say that, because I was expecting you to say she looked so great, she stepped out, she was being, you know, edgy. But you put it right back to, you know, some of the very, I mean, very harsh policies that her government and previous, you know, certainly conservative governments had that have left kids and women and so many out in the cold. Was that what you were trying to say with that?
100%. You almost concluded it for me. Thank you. it was unbelievable. And it was the sheer unabashed caucasity of it all to be so proud and marching out, looking so utterly fierce to say, you know how you pay me? Well, yeah, well, I'm wearing the spoils of what I've managed to acquire for you. And I'm going to tell you that there's nothing left because I've just spent it. So little Tommy is not going to get ruddy dinner anymore. And it was just absolutely like infuriating. And I don't come from anything. A lot of my friends don't come from anything. And we all have different backgrounds. We're all very mixed friendship group. But like the one thing we have in common is that it felt like they were taking the mickey. And so, yeah, like that song just jumped out for me, you know, like I can't help but.
Tell me, Yola, and we know Marcus Rashford, the football star, we know UNICEF, the UN Children's Fund, they're very concerned about exactly what you're talking about right here in England. So it's a fact. And I want to ask you, did any of that play any part of your desire to move from Bristol, Western England, to Nashville, Tennessee, music city of the world?
Well, I only moved just like properly. I was always traveling backwards and forwards in 2019. But 2020, I was like, you know what, I'm going to try and live between the two places. And then I got stuck here. So the main, and then I was like, I might as well just commit, Yola. And so I moved. So part of it was a practicality, but part of it was also that need to have a higher glass ceiling. I think I'd like to quote Gina Yashere. and she goes, you know, same BS, only the glass ceiling's higher. And so that's it. You know, we're not all that different either side of the pond. We're separated by a common language often, but the glass ceiling is a markedly higher here, specifically for dark-skinned black women. And that's what Gina Yashere was referring to. And Kelechi, another person that I follow, speaks of the same thing, you know. And so, yeah, they're not wrong. You know, you speak to any myriad of dark-skinned black
women. That is very interesting. Yeah, what you say about the color shades, and it's become a real issue, and it's really interesting to hear you talk about that, because again, you know, you talk about it in your songs. On your Instagram bio, you describe yourself as a musically genre bending 4-time Grammy nominee. I like that. Genre bending. Tell me the genre bending first.
Yes, I'm always describing as genre fluid was a term I coined to describe my music, because as Brits, look, we didn't have as genre radio as we do over here in America. And so you might have grown up listening to the radio where a playlist had Nirvana and like Bjork and Brownstone or Aaliyah or something all in one line, and then Blur. Like that's the era I grew up in, you know, where it was all just, we absorbed it all at the same time. And so like, it seems to be something that like maybe as music has got more genred, even in the UK, we've forgotten the very recent history of how we used to absorb music. And so like, that's just a reflection of my environment of growing up, listening to the radio, hovering over the radio on Sunday, listening to the top 40 and to the radio shows, and how they explored music in this free way. You know, that's what made me. And so that's who I am.
So I want to play a clip from your latest, Walk Through Fire, and then we'll talk about it.
That's my first.
It was easier to see.
So aptly corrected, this is stand for yourself, and what I said was your first. But I'm really interested by some of the words in there. You know, let go of yourself for a new beginning. It was easier to sing than to stand for myself. Tell me about that.
So when I was in the UK, there was a particular stigma associated with people that did backing vocals. It was maybe seen by some of the record executives that if you did any kind of supportive work in the music industry, that it couldn't be possible that you had any artistic license to create. And that's something that was almost unsaid, but you heard it. It was under the radar in the way that it was talked about. And also simultaneously to that, every time you went into the space as a musician, as an artist, people would suggest to the darker of us that had we considered doing backing singing work. And so they kind of worked in concert to subvert Black female autonomy. And the same thing didn't happen to males as much. And so it was very targeted at Black women. And so I had to spend a lot of time fighting for my right to be a lead singer, sometimes a lead singer for hire. But even in those scenarios, the idea of service was very hard to get over. And sometimes it was easier just to sing, like whatever, like if it's someone else's song that I'm filling in as their tour person for hire who can sing any, like, 15 songs, three of which are mine, you know, like it was easier for me to just kowtow to someone else's authority than it was to lead, because it was like, it was just enough to fight to be able to feature on a couple songs or to maybe have this idea of building something that was very different from being like a house vocalist or singing R&B or whatever the teeny tiny boxes that I was allowed into. And so it became like something that I had to like grow out of, this idea of what was easier. I always had to kind of search for the harder road, the road less traveled, maybe the road that didn't even have an example of or a role model for me to follow that was Black and British and a lady. And so I had to just, that's what, it was so much easier for so much of my life to just sing, you know, and as opposed to stand for myself. And so that's why I called the record Stand for Myself, because I'm standing for my right to nuance, not to be strong, like some monolithic strong Black, but to be nuanced and actually to write my own story.
And you know, as they say, agency, and you certainly seem to have, you know, really, you know, cracked that, which is great. We want to play out, obviously COVID has been so difficult for everybody, not only, you know, stopping your concerts, but everything. And there was, I want to play out, but I want you to explain me what we're going to look at Far Away Look, but it's Tiny Desk Concert. Just tell me about that before I play a clip.
Well, Tiny Desk Concerts are wonderful things. If you're acquainted with NPR, you'll know that they are shot in this lovely little enclave in the offices. And like, any number of legends have done it, and I was so honoured to do it. I sang the lead, the first track on my debut album for them, which is what you're going to hear, and it's kind of the precursor to my most current record. Like, I'm at this place of having checked out, and I have that faraway look in my eye. They're going, do this, because it's easier to sing, right? And stand for myself. And so I'm just singing and I'm not engaged. And so that's where we set our scene for this song, and in the company of Tiny Desk and the wonderful Bob Wiener.
So on that note, we are going to play Far Away Look. Yola, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a wonderful pleasure.
Lit the candles on the cake, threw the match down on the floor. Wish I knew.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.